Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ vassaṃ. So, I've just come back from Thailand. So I'm upside down in time zones, and temperature was 30 most days, and it's now 3 a.m. So I'm utterly confused. Not utterly. Our tradition comes from India, our monastic tradition, and it's latterly developed in Thailand, Sri Lanka, and Burma. And our particular monastery is a manifestation of what we call the forest tradition of monasteries in Thailand. And the forest tradition is a tradition that emphasizes meditation, a skillful use of our monastic discipline as a way of mindfulness, a life for the resident community of work, meditation, solitude, community. And you notice we bow a lot. And bowing is something that, like when we bow to the shrine here, we don't bow to some deity, or we don't obviously see the Buddha in that piece of plaster, because that would be idolatry, and we're not that dumb. But rather we use the rituals that we have as ways of developing mindfulness, developing a sense of respect, learning to stop, learning to compose the mind, because the mind's tendency is always to be preoccupied with all manner of thinking and past and future and doing this and doing that. And to actually bring the mind into the present moment is a interesting skill to develop. And to do it in a way which is not just from excitement or from fear, because it's easy to be present when there's an ice storm and you have to walk on, it's all slick, then you're really present, because if you're not, you're going to break your hip. Or to be present when there's something really exciting or interesting, it's also not so difficult to do. But to be present for the sake of presence, to be aware for the sake of awareness in the ordinary rather than the extraordinary, takes some skill, some training. But it reaps great rewards, because when we cultivate awareness, we really open to the nature of things, and that opening to the nature of things as they are rather than as we imagine them, or if we don't just notice them because we're lost in the past and the future, that opening to the present moment presents us with insight. And the Buddha's teaching is couched in various ways, but it's the whole thrust of the Buddha's teaching is to liberate human beings from suffering. And the cause of suffering in Buddhism, we say, is ignorance, not understanding clearly, not seeing the way things are. Not ignorance in terms of IQ, not in that sense, but ignorance in terms of wisdom. And it's rather like someone who doesn't understand the law of gravity and foolishly climbs up on an icy roof is going to feel the law of gravity pretty quick and slide down and break their leg, or worse. And the understanding of the truth, the way things are, that's a good analogy for it, because when we don't really understand the way things are, we tend to react from ego, from all kinds of cultural biases, familial upbringing stuff that we bring, and then we suffer. So the Buddha's approach to that is to try to develop a life which is meaningful socially, and the social teachings, social constructs that the Buddha suggested are very much based on mutual respect, mutual responsibility, mutual sense of caring for each other. And so you have teachings that talk about the relationship of parent to child and child to parent, that the parent's responsibility to the child is to care for the upbringing and education and well-being and physical nurturing of the child. And then the child has a responsibility to the parent, that the child looks out for the parent's needs. So it's this mutuality, husband to wife in the same way as wife to husband, employer to employee, employee to employer, parent to children, children to parent. So this is the sort of social construct that we try to live by here, where we try to have we have quite a strong hierarchy in Theravada Buddhism. So I'm the senior monk, and that is determined by when I ordained, and then other monks, when we fall in order in that way according to when we were ordained rather than our chronological age. And then within that we try to have a sense of deference for seniority, for elders, but always there's this mutuality. I try to care for the junior members of the community, they try to care for me. That's quite a, obviously, very, very beautiful way to relate. And we're fortunate in the sense that like competition and those kinds of things are pretty much sussed out pretty quick, because they just seem to be so utterly unnecessary and foolish. We can have competitive impulses or whatever, but that's not really important, is it? So we live by a rule or a discipline that allows us to share the resources that we have here, and try to encourage each other in the practices of Buddhism. So the social conventions that we live by, very much based on morality, renunciation, simplification, those kinds of things. And so the rituals that you see here are rituals that are developed in the fourth tradition. So the shrine, say the shrine has a Buddha image, candles, incense, and glass flowers. The Buddha image itself represents the awakened mind, the enlightened mind, that the mind which is not deluded. The candles represent wisdom. The incense represents the concentrated mind, and the flowers represent moral purity. So there's a whole symbology that exists there. And then when we bow three times. We bow to what we call the three refuges, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. The Buddha is that which is awake, the Dharma is truth, and the Sangha is the practice of living well, living meaningfully, and cultivating the heart. And so like, say in our tradition, whenever I come into my own room or my own cabin, I have a shrine there, and the tradition is to, first thing you do is you bow three times. And it's not efficient, it'd be much more efficient just to sit down. But the idea isn't efficiency or getting stuff done, but it's actually the idea is to stop, reflect, how is it now? Where are you at now? What's your mind doing now? Is your mind entertaining wholesome things or unwholesome things? And I think we all know how the mind can just spin out in resentment or into fantasizing, whatever. And to actually break this patterns of ego and self and habitual psychological patterns that we might get caught up into, it takes quite a lot of work. And so we have a lot of very skillful means in that way. Which are helpful for that. Even then, it's not so easy. So we're a very orthodox tradition too. In the sense that we try to stay to the old conventions and use them for our practice. But orthodoxy also has to be conjoined with what we call orthopraxy, and orthopraxy is using the conventions of this particular tradition. Not in a way just which is superstitious or bound by fear or bound by some authoritarian figure telling us we have to do this, but rather the orthopraxy is to use the conventions that we have to try to develop mindfulness and see why we suffer, why we create problems around the way things are. So in Buddhism, the lay life isn't so well defined. It's monastic life, because at the time of the Buddha and now, people have all manner of lifestyles, all manner of livelihoods. So the Buddha could not prescribe like a particular way of living for each person. So whereas for the monastic order, the Buddha could prescribe very detailed ways of developing community, sharing resources, developing mindfulness individually, because we are all, say, we're committed, as we are ordained, to a particular lifestyle. But not very many people want to be monastics, and not many people are maybe suited to it. But one philosopher I read once, he said, not everyone has the vocation to be a monastic, but everyone has a bit of the monastic in them. And I think what he was pointing to is that we all aspire to something meaningful in our own hearts and minds. And that aspiration, I think, is really the point of monasticism and the point of any spiritual life. What I find in Western culture, like I've just come from Thailand, which is 99% Buddhist. Thailand has usually around, it changes, fluctuates, usually about 300,000 monks. So it's, for me, it's monks' heaven. So I was telling the monks this morning that when I arrived in the Suvarnabhumi Airport in Bangkok, a friend of mine used to be his police colonel, was in charge of security and customs at this airport. He used to be in charge of it, so he's got some connections. So when I get off the plane, there was a man, an immigration officer, right at the gate. He welcomes me, greets me, and he's got one of these little golf carts ready for me, zips me off to immigration, stamps my passport. I go through immigration. There's another man from security whose friend I also know, and he takes my bags, and then they take me to a car. So it's a VIP treatment. Toronto was different. They said, go over there, we want to look at your bags. Okay. Interestingly enough, they didn't look through my bags, they looked through my iPad. What are you looking for? So, two different worlds. But both are good, both are fine. So our social life is defined in ways that are very important, because if our social life is confused or whatever, we can never still the mind. But the real thrust of the Buddhist teaching is to see that there, in consciousness, there is a possibility to be truly free and deeply compassionate. There is this possibility. And obviously, if our social life is sloppy or compromised or whatever, it's going to just affect us, and we'll be obsessed by it, preoccupied by it. So the idea of good social conventions in Buddhism is that they are, we'd say, a method or a foundation for calmness of mind. And then from that foundation also, because even if you have a good moral foundation and a good social foundation, the mind can still be pretty busy. So also then the Buddhist teaching says that it's very necessary to develop a way to compose the mind, to make the mind still, to bring the mind into a sense of settledness, into a sense of presence, so that there's a possibility of really observing consciousness and understanding why we suffer. And so the Buddhist teaching is usually divided into sort of two platforms. One is this, where we talk about social conventions, who we are and how to live life and what morality means and so on. And the other is to look at life not as a social situation, but a stream of consciousness. So we can do both. I can both be engaged in a committee meeting and talking with people about plans about the monastery and difficulties with this and that, so that I engage socially with the committee members. But also I can observe the stream of consciousness that I'm experiencing, how I like what someone says, how I don't like what someone says, how maybe I'm tired and the meeting's going on and I'm bored with it, or how maybe my stomach is grumbling. So there's a whole stream of conscious events that are going on, as well as my social interaction. And that capacity to practice what we call inner vigilance, or to have like two levels of knowing what is socially appropriate, but knowing also what's going on in consciousness. This is something that I think we all develop. If we didn't, I think we'd be committed. But we really enhance that second part, is to try to notice stream of consciousness and not define it as me or mine, but just to see it. Well, stream of consciousness has these different elements, and it has emotion in it. It has preference in it. It has perceptions in it. It has feelings or it has memory. Yeah? So although I have my memories and you have your memories, memories come and go. I have my physical pains and pleasures, and you have your physical pains. But pain and pleasure is a natural phenomenon. And what we sometimes don't notice is that because we're so preoccupied with the phenomena of consciousness, we're so preoccupied with our thoughts and our plans and our views and opinions and our memories and our prejudices and biases and our emotional passions and so on, we're so preoccupied with all the movement, with all the things and objects and things that come and go, come and go, come and go, we don't notice that actually this all comes and goes in awareness. And that awareness itself has no taste. It has no smell. It isn't a particular kind of perception. It doesn't have size. It doesn't... it's stainless. Awareness is stainless, isn't it? I can feel terribly ticked off at someone in one part of the day and feel quite relaxed in the other part of the day. But awareness is not really afflicted or conditioned by any of that. Awareness knows this is a feeling of being irritated at someone's behavior, and this is the relief of laying down in the evening when I'm relaxed. And so what we try to do in Buddhist awareness practice is having done what is right socially, and being socially responsible. It's very, very important. Otherwise, Buddhist meditation out of context can seem very irresponsible. But living within our responsibilities, what we try to cultivate is, what I was trying to indicate in this meditation is that you can listen to sound, and you can feel the body. And I like to do that. I like to toggle between the two, listen to sound. And to do that, you have to come in the present moment. If I'm thinking about what I'm going to do tomorrow, or I'm annoyed at what someone said to me today, and I'm just preoccupied with this movement of emotion and thought, and I don't notice it, I'm not in the present moment. I'm caught in the past or going to the future. So the sort of paramount instruction and suggestion is present moment awareness. And that's quite a step in itself, to actually come into the present moment, not to get rid of anything or to become anything, but to simply open the mind to the reality of what's going on in consciousness. And that's one of the practices we're trying to do. If we watch the breath, or we do a mantra, or we do a visualization, it's not to create a particular fantastic state of mind, peaceful state of mind, but it's actually to cultivate long stretches of presence. And some people do it different ways. Some people do it using Tai Chi, some yoga, some sport, working out, different ways. So if we can do that, if we can sustain awareness for long periods of time, and we can notice that the moods that come up are phenomena, they're objects. Like I can feel, if I just taught a retreat in Chiang Mai, and I had a memory come up of something that happened to me maybe 10 years ago, because it got triggered by a question or something, and it was a very intense, as a surprise, this was really strong anger. And because I knew it as a memory, it came, hung up, and it was gone in about 30 seconds, but very intense. And if I'm not aware, if I'm just always reacting to these things or caught up in them, then these movements, I become preoccupied with them, and I miss something very essential, is that freedom of the mind is not an experience per se. It's not like having a mind that never has thoughts, or having a mind that never feels fear, or having a mind that it is always in some way has some kind of emotional stillness or whatever. That's not really peace, because the mind, the nature of mind, the nature of emotion, the nature of thought is movement. It comes and goes. And one of the Buddha's instructions is, can you notice movement rather than being always selecting the movement that you would like? Can you notice the arising and ceasing of emotions and thoughts and memories and plans as a movement and no longer be moved by it? And that's the instruction on impermanence. We emphasize a lot in Buddhism that which has a nature to begin has a nature to cease. Now, we all know that. But actually to use that perception of change constantly brings you to the unchanging. What I notice in Thailand is, like, Thailand is a country which is imbued with Buddhism, and their language is imbued with Buddhist ideas, and it's so pervasive, and there are lots of monks teaching, and lots of books, lots of publications, there's stuff on television, that one of the dangers in a Buddhist culture is that, and this is a danger here too, is that the language of Buddhism becomes so familiar that we just agree with it. An agreement on a teaching is not the same as practicing a teaching. So orthodoxy is agreement on a teaching, but orthopraxy is like taking a teaching and actually employing it. And one of the things that Buddhism employs is perception, like, rather than belief. Because if you believe in Buddhism, you won't get anywhere. Nice belief, not a bad belief. But you won't really penetrate what the Buddha is pointing to, because an agreement is dead. An agreement isn't dynamic. You know, I agree, things change, and then what? But actually, to take a perception like change, this is changing, and to constantly notice that aspect of the mind-body phenomenon, to notice that aspect of this stream of consciousness. If you constantly do that, you begin to abide as witness of change, and in that abiding witnessing, you begin to find that there's a profound peace through change. The desire mind, we say, the desire mind, and desire mind's not wrong, it's very useful at times, it's at times destructive, but the desire mind is always trying to change something towards pleasure and away from pain, and that's natural. So I felt my legs were hurting, had a break, stretched my legs, feel better, so we use that. But if that's the only strategy we have, always seeking to maximize pleasure, minimize pain, if that's the only strategy we have, then we'll always be restless, because the changing nature of our emotions and our body and all the rest of it is pleasure, pain, pleasure, pain, pleasure, pain, and some kind of neutrality between them. So the teachings of the Buddha are saying, okay, that's natural. Pleasure and pain are natural. There's nothing wrong with them. But can you find a place in your heart which sees the arising of pleasure, sees the arising of pain, and isn't compelled always to follow the pleasure-pain cycles? Not to dismiss them, because that would be unnatural. So, like, this is a common thing we experience in meditation. So, like, my legs started to hurt. They weren't doing well today. So maybe around 20 minutes. And I looked at the clock. I said, oh my gosh. And I seriously thought of ringing the bell early. I've got a bit of power here. And I'm, no, wait a minute, let's just see what's pain is in awareness. So when the pain came up, then I have a choice. Is it life-threatening? Is it harmful? If it's harmful, I move, right? But much of pain isn't harmful. It's just the body is an uncomfortable place much of the time. So I chose to say, no, let's just see. This is in awareness. I want to take that posture of in awareness, rather than me being someone who has pain, which is true, but also I can take that witnessing posture and say, pain is in awareness. You begin to find peace within discomfort. And then discomfort isn't so, unless it's really hurtful, you know, again, I'm not saying, you know, just willfully hold yourself and don't move. But that's a very important lesson in meditation and life in general, that you can be at peace with the unpleasant. We all know that. We all know that. But in meditation, you amplify that. You say, well, yeah, look at that. The mind's peaceful within the unpleasant. And then the need to pursue the pleasant becomes much, much less, because you find in your heart there is something which is more profound and more interesting than pleasure and pain. But if my leg really starts to hurt, I move it and get up. So this capacity to know movement rather than be moved by it. And desire mind, of course, is always moving out into the objects of sense, into thought and into emotions, and saying, how can I fix it? How can I get rid of it? How can I do something about it? Through distraction and what like repression and we're just trying to see if I can sustain this kind of witnessing awareness to the way things are. And that's different than the way we're usually taught to put an end to suffering. We're usually taught to put an end to suffering is just by getting what you want and getting rid of what you don't want. And that works to a certain extent, certainly. But ultimately, no. Ultimately, no, because it's always limited by externalities. If you just think about it, if my peace and my well-being is dependent on anything external, another person, my body, my emotions, because these are all external to awareness. Awareness knows emotion. Awareness knows bodily feeling. So if my well-being is always dependent on the emotional state that comes up, if it's dependent on the physical state that comes up, if it's dependent on some kind of social relationship I have, if it's dependent on that, then as soon as that manifests in a way which isn't according to my liking, then I'm a victim. And yet, to have good friendships, to do yoga, to have a good diet, all these things are important. All these things are important. So in Buddhism, we try to do both. Try to do the very best you can with the body, the very best one can with the social conventions that one lives by, the very best one can in terms of generosity and social action in whatever way one's all. Because these are real beautiful things. And that kind of inner beauty allows the mind to be much more strong, much more into that witnessing. If I'm happy in myself because I've lived morally, if I feel well in myself because I've given what I can of my resources, if I shared my life in some way, that happiness makes it much more easy to be aware. Much, much more. If I've lived unskillfully, then there's a lot of regret, remorse, blaming, and so on. So in Buddhism, we'd say social happiness or social well-being is a method rather than the goal. If the goal is social well-being, what do you do with some kind of social conflict or anything? Well, I have to change it now. You don't have to change it. So I do, personally, we all try to do our utmost to create a social situation and so on that is good and meaningful for all of us. But that's a very limited thing. So we say happiness, compassion, social justice, these are methods, not goals. That's a different way to look at it. Like compassion, I do my utmost to not harm other beings and to not harm myself. And that, what does that do? That makes me more content. As I become more content, I can witness change without always having to change things. The reflection on change itself is a method rather than a conclusion. So if it's a method, I'm always needing to apply it. Like if you take, I always like to give the analogy of a glass half full, glass half empty. Okay, as a conclusion, if I'm really, let's say I'm really cynical, pessimistic, and someone indicates that to me, I say, oh yeah, that makes sense, doesn't it? But if I just leave it like that, my cynicism, pessimism will still dominate me. Or maybe I'll say, oh, that's naive and silly and so on. But what if I see that my mind is habitually cynical, habitually pessimistic, and I decide, no, my attention just gets caught by that. I'm just a victim to that. I like to work with that. I like to work with that. I like to see if I can not just follow that blindly. And so then I start to pick up the perception of half full. So when my mind goes, it's empty, I say, oh, but it's half full. That's dynamic. That's something I have to do constantly because that habit is so strong, right? So that's dynamic. And that dynamism is what we mean by wisdom in Buddhism. Wisdom is a faculty rather than a conclusion. Knowledge is a conclusion. So I conclude, yeah, that makes a lot of sense, Charlie. I agree with you and don't do anything about it. That doesn't really liberate the mind. And that's what we mean by orthopraxy. Okay, I agree with teaching or whatever, but then I have to do it. So my mind comes up, and this is just an example, but my mind starts to present a very cynical or critical view of life, how poorly done I am. And it might be true, but I see, well, if I always dwell in that, that's my limitation. I say, I'm going to try to see the goodness in my life, half full. I have to keep doing that. That's not going to happen because I agree with it. I have to do it because the habits of mine are much stronger than any conclusion. And this is the idea of using the perception of impermanence in Buddhism. Again, obviously I know that the seasons will change and that this body will die and da-da-da-da-da. It doesn't take a Buddha to figure that out. But I think the genius of the Buddha was that if you can sustain that perspective, then the tendency to grasp any of these changing conditions, that keeps falling away. And as that keeps falling away, you notice that awareness, the unchanging knowing, is actually very, very peaceful, and you don't need objects. And you begin to see that all objects point to the knowing, to the awareness. You say, wow, look at that, it's always possible. Now, awareness is always possible, but happiness isn't. Awareness is always possible, but inspiration isn't. Awareness is always possible, but good knees are not. Yeah? And this is the beauty of awareness. It's always something that is available. It's always available. All we need to do is remember, this is the way it is now. And it's so utterly simple and plain that it seems, so what? And to actually take that suggestion and really wake up to this moment, it's like this now. Good, bad, indifferent, and practice that. And the way you do that is you use the perception of change, anicca sanya in Pali. And the most difficult thing to be aware of is, of course, unfulfilled desire. So when we get something that we don't want, or we can't get what we do want, of course we feel restless, or we feel annoyed. And not to deny that we can seek things out, but just in life situations, so often, isn't it? You get something you don't want. Someone says something to you which is rude. You know, you get indigestion, cataracts. Someone cuts you off in the traffic. You're boiling the milk and you look away and it boils over. So we get things we don't want. And you know, we have to live efficiently, but to actually then be with unfulfilled desire is very, very hard. And so what the desire mind does, it then seeks some kind of compensation. It seems to get what it wants. And that's the restlessness the Buddha was asking us to look at. Take a look at that. Just wait. Don't just pursue that. Like we say that if someone has a divorce, don't find another partner on the rebound. So we all have that common wisdom, don't we? So the person suffers a divorce and it's terrible and they feel very, very lonely and then, ooh, I want to fall in love. And we all said, well, slow down. What are we saying? We say, be with unfulfilled desire first. Be with your, work that out first. Otherwise, you're going to be projecting all kinds of stuff onto this other person, and that's not the person. That's not who they are. It's your need that you're projecting on, right? So we know that, don't we? And what are we doing when we do that is we're noticing unfulfilled desire. So the person has this terrible sense of loss and failure and loneliness and da-da-da-da goes on, or betrayal. You know, it can be very, very nasty, those kinds of things. And then there's that, and that feeling is not a feeling I want. It's not a, you know, who wants that? Who wants that feeling? And so the desire mind seeks some kind of compensation. Food, drugs, another relationship, which is not wrong, but to actually be with the feelings of loneliness, to be with the feelings of betrayal, whatever, and to allow that, the awareness, just to be aware, this is changing, it arises, no, it's not changing, it's going to be forever, no, it'll change, it's not sure, it'll change. And all of us, I think, have done that work, and you ride it out, and you get to some kind of peaceful conclusion, then first of all, your choices are much more mindful and realistic, but also what you've done, or what we've done, is enhance awareness. And we've seen that awareness can even endure this, even, you know, feelings of loneliness and betrayal, that they will change. And it begins, intuitively, it begins to become apparent that your real refuge is awareness, rather than the qualities of consciousness that come and go. And that's a very liberating kind of insight, because then from then on, you're not dependent on others. And yet, you can give and share and love and lose and whatever, but you realize that the heart of freedom is not dependent on a condition. It knows conditions, it knows change. So these kinds of teachings are very, they take a lot of maturity. You know, take a lot of maturity. So if the person, you know, they go through a terrible divorce, and then they blame the other person, or, you know, this person did, yeah, maybe it's true, but you won't find your freedom that way. And then someone says to them, just be aware of change. No, I don't want to blame. Where the mature mind says, yeah, life is this way, feels this way now, and takes the good, bad, and the indifferent, and begins to cultivate a way of being, and this is what we mean by transcendence in Buddhism. Not transcendence, you get out of anything. You don't get out of bodily pain unless you do something nasty to yourself, like suicide. It's part of the deal. But transcendence is a sense of peacefulness within bodily pain. I had some work done, and I had some dental work. When I go to Thailand, I always get my teeth done because I know a man that owns a dental hospital, which is very handy. And dentists are very expensive, but he's made open invitation to me. So I had a couple of hours of serious work. And it was interesting, just like feeling the pain and feeling the tension of the body, but just staying with that witness. And even though it was unpleasant, as I always find dentists to be, not dentists, I find that the dentists are pleasant, it's just the activity. But just staying in that, you know, like practicing right there, okay, here's a chance, this is a chance. You're trapped now, what are you going to do? Complain, bite the dentist? What is awareness here, and what is the pain? And just that kind of contemplation within the discomfort of having your mouth jammed open for 2 hours. And just staying with that witness is actually very peaceful. But the body was like, it was terrible. The body didn't like it at all. But the mind could know that. I brush my teeth much more diligently now, but I don't think that's going to help. So these okay, you know, like this, the practice of awareness is always possible, isn't it? Wherever you are. And it's interesting because it really, for me, it makes life very meaningful. You know, where's the meaning in a dental chair? Get it over with, right? Give me the Novocaine, put me out. But actually, trying to take all these situations, the complexities, and see how can I cultivate awareness of change? Can I be the witness to this now? So it's a kind of meaningful challenge to take on as life presents itself in its various forms and manners. So the Buddha's teaching is quite brilliant in the sense that it takes human suffering, human discontent. I said, well, you know, you can find a way to witness that and not be caught by it. So it takes the very thing that we want to get rid of. He says, use that. Use the dental chair to figure out a way to be aware. And, you know, I caught, you know, we do that as monks. We say, well, okay, what if I die in the mental chair, in the dental chair? What if I die now? It's a really powerful reflection. You know, how would I do if I died right now? How would I be? Would I be mindful? Would I be aware? Would I just be all caught up and so on? So we use those kind of reflections to make these different kinds of situations meaningful. So Buddhism has a vast kind of array of teachings, some social, meditative, contemplative, and then the kind of transcendent. And obviously, being in the business, I'm very much interested in the transcendent. But I do realize that the transcendent reflection isn't possible without good living, good social living. All right, I'll leave that for your reflection.
Annamayang dhammakathaya sadhukarang dadamase sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.